I know the seas and rivers, the shapes of the coasts, where the rocks and shoals lie. I know hidden coves where a boat can land unseen, and I know that a king protects his people, or he is no king at all."
Stannis's face darkened.
"You mock me to my face. Must I learn a king's duty from an onion smuggler?"
Davos knelt.
"If I have offended, take my head. I'll die as I lived, your loyal man. But hear me first. Hear me for the sake of the onions I brought you and the fingers you took."
Stannis slid Lightbringer from its scabbard. Its glow filled the chamber.
"Say what you will, but say it quickly."
The muscles in the king's neck stood out like cords. Davos fumbled inside his cloak and drew out the crinkled sheet of parchment. It seemed a thin and flimsy thing, yet it was all the shield he had.
"A king's hand should be able to read and write. Maester Pylos has been teaching me."
He smoothed the letter flat upon his knee and began to read by the light of the magic sword.
Victarion. The sea was black and the moon was silver as the iron fleet swept down on the prey. They sighted her in the narrows between the Isle of Cedars and the rugged hills of the Astapori hinterlands, just as the black priest Makoro had said they would. "Gascari!" Longwater Pike shouted down from the crow's nest. Victarion Greyjoy watched her sail grow larger from the forecastle. Soon he could make out her oars rising and falling, and the long white wake behind her shining in the moonlight, like a scar across the sea. "Not a true warship," Victarion realized. "A trading galley, and a big one." She would make a fine prize. He signaled to his captains to give chase. They would board this ship and take her. The captain of the galley had realized his peril by then. He changed course for the west, making for the Isle of Cedars, perhaps hoping to shelter in some hidden cove, or run his pursuers onto the jagged rocks along the island's northeast coast. His galley was heavy laden, though, and the Ironborn had the wind. Grief and Iron Victory cut across the quarry's course, while Swift, Sparrowhawk, and Agile Finger Dancer swept behind her. Even then, the Gascara captain did not strike his banners. By the time Lamentation came alongside the prey, raking her larboard side and splintering her oars, both ships were so close to the haunted ruins of Gozai that they could hear the monkeys chattering as the first dawn light washed over the city's broken pyramids. Their prize was named Gascari Dawn, the galley's captain said, when he was delivered to Victarion in chains. She was out of New Gis, and was returning there by way of Yunkai, after trading at Mirin. The man spoke no decent tongue, but only a guttural Gascari, full of growls and hisses, as ugly a language as Victarion Greyjoy had ever heard. Makaro translated the captain's words into the common tongue of Westeros. The war for Mirin was won, the captain claimed. The Dragon Queen was dead, and a Gascari by the name of Hisdak rule the city now. Victarion had his tongue torn out for lying. Daenerys Targaryen was not dead, Makaro assured him. His Red Guard, R'hllor, had shown him the queen's face in his sacred fires. The captain could not abide lies, so he had the Gascari captain bound hand and foot and thrown overboard, a sacrifice to the drowned god. "Your Red Guard will have his due," he promised Makaro. "But the seas are ruled by the drowned god."
"There are no gods, but R'hllor and the other, whose name may not be said."
The sorcerer priest was garbed in somber black, but for a hint of golden thread at collar, cuffs, and hem. There was no red cloth aboard the Iron Victory, but it was not meet that Makaro go about in the salt-stained rags he had been wearing when the Vole fished him from the sea. So Viterin had commanded Tom Tidewood to sew new robes for him from whatever was at hand, and had even donated some of his own tunics to the purpose. Of black and gold those were, for the arms of House Greyjoy showed a golden kraken on a black field, and the banners and sails of their ships displayed the same. The crimson and scarlet robes of the Red Priests were alien to the Ironborn, but Victorian had hoped his men might accept Makaro more easily once clad in Greyjoy colours. He hoped in vain. Clad in black from head to heel, with a mask of red and orange flames tattooed across his face, the priest appeared more sinister than ever. The crew shunned him when he walked the deck, and men would spit if his shadow chanced to fall upon them. Even the Vole, who had fished the Red Priest from the sea, had urged Victorian to give him to the drowned god. But Makaro knew these strange shores in ways the Ironborn did not, and secrets of the dragon kind as well. "The crow's eye keeps wizards. Why shouldn't I?" His black sorcerer was more puissant than all of Urin's three, even if you threw them in a pot and boiled them down to one. The damn hare might disapprove, but Aaron and his pieties were far away. So Victorian closed his burned hand into a mighty fist and said, "Gascari Dawn is no fit name for a ship of the Iron Fleet. For you, wizard, I shall rename her Red God's Wrath." His wizard bowed his head.
"As the captain says."
And the ships of the Iron Fleet numbered 54 once again. The next day a sudden squall descended on them. Makaro had predicted that as well. When the rains moved on, three ships were found to have vanished. Victorian had no way to know whether they had foundered, run aground, or been blown off course. "They know where we're going," he told his crew. "If they are still afloat, we will meet again." The Iron Captain had no time to wait for laggards, not with his bride encircled by her enemies. "The most beautiful woman in the world has urgent need of my axe." Besides, Makaro assured him that the three ships were not lost. Each night, the sorcerer priest would kindle a fire on the forecastle of the Iron Victory and stalk around the flames, chanting prayers. The firelight made his black skin shine like polished onyx, and sometimes Victorian could swear that the flames tattooed on his face were dancing too, twisting and bending, melting into one another, their colours changing with every turn of the priest's head. "The black priest is calling demons down on us," one oarsman was heard to say. When that was reported to Victorian, he had the man scourged until his back was blood from shoulders to buttocks. So when Makaro said,
"Your lost lambs will return to the flock off the isle called Yaris,"
the captain said, "Pray that they do, priest, or you may be the next to taste the whip." The sea was blue and green, and the sun blazing down from an empty blue sky when the Iron Fleet took its second prize, in the waters north and west of Astabor. This time it was a Mirish cog, named Dove, on her way to Yonkai by way of New Gis with a cargo of carpets, sweet green wines, and Mirish lace. Her captain owned a Mirish eye that made far-off things look close. Two glass lenses in a series of brass tubes, cunningly wrought, so that each section slid into the next until the eye was no longer than a dirk. Victorian claimed that treasure for himself. The cog he renamed Shrike. Her crew would be kept for ransom, the captain decreed. They were neither slaves nor slavers, but free meremen and seasoned sailors. Such men were worth good coin. Sailing out of Mir, the Dove brought them no fresh news of Mirin or Daenerys, only stale reports of Dothraki horsemen along the Rhoyne, the Golden Company upon the march, and other things Viterian already knew. "What do you see?" the captain asked his black priest that night, as Makoro stood before his nightfire. "What awaits us on the morrow? More rain?" It smelled like rain to him.
"Grey skies and strong winds," Makoro said. "No rain. Behind come the tigers. Ahead awaits your dragon."
"Your dragon?" Victorian liked the sound of that. "Tell me something I do not know, priest."
"The captain commands, and I obey," said Makoro.
The crew had taken to calling him the Black Flame, a name fastened on him by Stefar Stamera, who could not say Makoro. By any name, the priest had powers.
"The coastline here runs west to east," he told Viterium. "When it turns north, you will come unto more hares, swift ones with many legs."
And so it came to pass. This time the prey proved to be a pair of galleys, long and sleek and fast. Rolf the Limper was the first to sight them, but they soon outdistanced Woe and Forlorn Hope, so Victorian sent Ironwing, Sparrowhawk, and Kraken's Kiss to run them down. He had no swifter ships than those three. The pursuit lasted the best part of the day, but in the end both galleys were boarded and taken, after brief but brutal fights. They had been running empty, Victorian learned, making for New Gis to load supplies and weapons for the Gascari legions in camp before Mirin, and bring fresh legionnaires to the war, to replace all the men who died. "Men slain in battle?" asked Victorian. The crews of the galleys denied it. The deaths were from a bloody flux. The Pale Mare, they called it, and like the captain of the Gascari Dawn, the captains of the galleys repeated the lie that Daenerys Targaryen was dead. "Give her a kiss for me, in whatever hell you find her," Victorian said. He called for his axe and took their heads off there and then. Afterwards he put their crews to death as well, saving only the slaves chained to the oars. He broke their chains himself and told them they were now free men and would have the privilege of rowing for the Iron Fleet, an honour that every boy in the Iron Islands dreamed of growing up. "A dragon queen, free slaves, and so do I," he proclaimed. The galleys he renamed Ghost and Shade, "for I mean them to return and haunt these Yunkishmen," he told the dusky woman that night after he had taken his pleasure of her. They were close now, and growing closer every day. "We will fall upon them like a thunderbolt," he said, as he squeezed the woman's breast. He wondered if this was how his brother Aaron felt when the drowned guard spoke to him. He could almost hear the guard's voice welling up from the depths of the sea. "You shall serve me well, my captain," the wave seemed to say. "It was for this I made you." But he would feed the Red Guard too, Makara's fire guard. The arm the priest had healed was hideous to look upon, pork crackling from elbow to fingertips. Sometimes when Victorian closed his hand, the skin would split and smoke. Yet the arm was stronger than it had ever been. "Two guards are with me now," he told the dusky woman. "No foe can stand before two guards." Then he rolled her on her back and took her once again. When the cliffs of Yaris appeared off their larboard bows, he found his three lost ships waiting for him, just as Makoro had promised. Victorian gave the priest a golden torque as a reward. Now he had a choice to make. Should he risk the straits or take the Iron Fleet around the island? The memory of Fair Isle still rankled in the Iron Captain's memory. Stannis Baratheon had descended on the Iron Fleet from both north and south whilst they were trapped in the channel between the island and the mainland, dealing Victorian his most crushing defeat. But sailing around Yaris would cost him precious days. With Yunkai so near, Shipping in the straits was like to be heavy, but he did not expect to encounter Yunkish warships until they were closer to Mirin. What would the crow's eye do? He brooded on that for a time, then signalled to his captains. We sail the straits! Three more prizes were taken before Yarrus dwindled off their sterns. A fat galleas fell to the Vole and Grief, and a trading galley to Manfred Merlin of Kite. Their holds were packed with trade goods, wines, and silks and spices, rare woods and rarer scents. But the ships themselves were the true prize. Later that same day, a fishing catch was taken by Seven Skulls and Thrall's Bane. She was a small, slow, dingy thing, hardly worth the effort of boarding. Victorian was displeased to hear that it had taken two of his own ships to bring the fishermen to heel. Yet it was from their lips that he heard of the Black Dragon's return. "The Silver Queen is gone," the catch's master told him. "She flew away upon her dragon beyond the Dothraki Sea." "Where is this Dothraki Sea?" he demanded. "I will sail the armed fleet across it and find the queen wherever she may be." The fisherman laughed aloud. "That would be a sight worth seeing. The Dothraki Sea is made of grass, fool." He should not have said that. Victorian took him around the throat with his burned hand and lifted him bodily into the air, slamming him back against the mast. He squeezed till the Yunkishman's face turned as black as the fingers digging into his flesh. The man kicked and writhed for a while, trying fruitlessly to pry loose the captain's grip. "No man calls Victorian Greyjoy a fool and lives to boast of it." When he opened his hand, the man's limp body flopped to the deck. Longwater Pike and Tom Tidewood chucked it over the rail, another offering to the drowned god.
"Your drowned god is a demon,"
the black priest Makaro said afterwards.
"He's no more than a thrall of the other, the dark god whose name must not be spoken."
"Take care, priest," Victorian warned him. "There are godly men aboard this ship who would tear out your tongue for speaking such blasphemies. Your red god will have his due, I swear it. My word is iron. Ask any of my men." The black priest bowed his head.
"There is no need. The Lord of Light has shown me your worth, Lord Captain. Every night in my fires I glimpse the glory that awaits you."
Those words pleased Victorian Greyjoy mightily, as he told the dusky woman that night. "My brother Balin was a great man," he said, "but I shall do what he could not. The Iron Islands shall be free again, and the old way will return. Even Dagon could not do that." Almost 100 years had passed since Dagon Greyjoy sat the sea stone chair, but the Ironborn still told tales of his raids and battles. In Dagon's day, a weak king sat the Iron Throne, his rheumy eyes fixed across the narrow sea where bastards and exiles plotted rebellion. So, forth from Pike, Lord Dagon sailed, to make the sunset sea his own. He bearded the lion in his den and tied the direwolf's tail in knots. But even Dagon could not defeat the dragons. "But I shall make the dragon queen mine own. She will share my bed and bear me many mighty sons." That night the ships of the Iron Fleet numbered 60. Strange sails grew more common north of Yarrus. They were very near to Yunkai, and the coast between the Yellow City and Mirin would be teeming with merchantmen and supply ships coming and going. So Victorian took the Iron Fleet out into the deeper waters, beyond the sight of land. Even there, they would encounter other vessels. "Let none escape to give warning to our foes," the Iron Captain commanded. None did. The sea was green and the sky was grey the morning Grief and Warrior Wench and Victorian's own Iron Victory captured the slaver galley from Yunkai in the waters due north of the Yellow City. In her holds were 20 perfume boys and 80 girls destined for the pleasure houses of Lice. Her crew never thought to find peril so close to their home waters, and the Ironborn had little trouble taking her. She was named the Willing Maiden. Victorian put the slavers to the sword, then sent his men below to unchain the rowers. "You row for me now. Row hard, and you shall prosper." The girls he divided amongst his captains. "The Lyseni would have made whores of you," he told them, "but we have saved you. Now you need only serve one man instead of many. Those who please their captains may be taken as salt wives, an honourable station." The perfume boys he wrapped in chains and threw into the sea. They were unnatural creatures, and the ship smelled better once cleansed of their presence. For himself, Victorian claimed the 7 choicest girls. One had red gold hair and freckles on her teats. One shaved herself all over. One was brown-haired and brown-eyed, shy as a mouse. One had the biggest breasts he'd ever seen. The 5th was a little thing, with straight black hair and golden skin. Her eyes were the colour of amber. The 6th was white as milk, with golden rings through her nipples and her nether lips. The 7th, black as a squid's ink. The slavers of Yunkai had trained them in the way of the 7 sighs, but that was not why Victorian wanted them. His dusky woman was enough to satisfy his appetites until he could reach Meereen and claim his queen. No man had need of candles when the sun awaited him. The galley he renamed the Slaver's Scream. With her, the ships of the Iron Fleet numbered 61. "Every ship we capture makes us stronger," Victorian told his Ironborn. "But from here it will grow harder. On the morrow or the day after, we are like to meet with warships. We are entering the home waters of Meereen, where the fleets of our foes await us. We will meet with ships from all 3 slaver cities, ships from Tolos and Illyria and New Gis, even ships from Karth." He took care not to mention the green galleys of old Valentis, that surely must be sailing up through the Gulf of Grief, even as he spoke. "These slavers are feeble things. You have seen how they run before us, heard how they squeal when we put them to the sword. Every man of you is worth 20 of them, for only we are made of iron. Remember this. When first we next spy some slaver sails, give no quarter and expect none." "What need have we of quarter? We are the Ironborn, and 2 guards look over us. We will seize their ships, smash their hopes, and turn their bay to blood." A great cry went up at his words. The captain answered with a nod, grim-faced, then called for the 7 girls he had claimed to be brought on deck, the loveliest of all those found aboard the Willing Maiden. He kissed them each upon the cheeks and told them of the honour that awaited them, though they did not understand his words. Then he had them put aboard the fishing catch that they had captured, cut her loose, and had her set afire. "With this gift of innocence and beauty, we honour both the gods," he proclaimed, as the warships of the Iron Fleet rode past the burning catch. "Let these girls be reborn in light, undefiled by mortal lust, or let them descend to the drowned gods' watery halls to feast and dance and laugh until the seas dry up." Near the end, before the smoking ketch was swallowed by the sea, the cries of the 7 sweetlings changed to joyous song, it seemed to Victorian Greyjoy. A great wind came up then, a wind that filled their sails and swept them north and east and north again, toward Meereen and its pyramids of many-coloured bricks. "On wings of song I fly to you, Daenerys," the Iron Captain thought. That night, for the first time, he brought forth the dragon horn that the crow's eye had found amongst the smoking wastes of Great Valeria. A twisted thing it was, 6 feet long from end to end, gleaming black and banded with red gold and dark Valerian steel.
Euron's hell horn.
Victorian ran his hand along it. The horn was as warm and smooth as a dusky woman's thighs, and so shiny that he could see a twisted likeness of his own features in its depths. Strange sorcerous writings had been cut into the bands that girded it.
Valerian glyphs, Macaro called them.
That much Victorian had known.
What do they say?
Much and more.
The Black Priest pointed to one golden band.
Here the horn is named. I am Dragon Binder, it says. Have you ever heard it sound?
Once.
One of his brother's mongrels had sounded the hell horn at the king's moot on Old Wick. A monster of a man he had been, huge and shaven-headed, with rings of gold and jet and jade, around arms thick with muscle, and a great hawk tattooed across his chest.
The sound it made, it burned somehow, as if my bones were on fire, searing my flesh from within. Those writings glowed red-hot, then white-hot, and painful to look upon. It seemed as if the sound would never end. It was like some lung scream, 1,000 screams, all melted into one.
And the man who blew the horn, what of him?
He died. There were blisters on his lips after. His bird was bleeding too. The captain thumped his chest. The hawk, just here. Every feather dripping blood. I heard the man was all burned up inside. But that might just have been some tale.
A true tale.
Macaro turned the hell horn, examining the queer letters that crawled across a second of the golden bands.
Here it says, no mortal man shall sound me and live.
Bitterly, Victorian brooded on the treachery of brothers. Euron's gifts are always poisoned. The crow's eye swore this horn would bind dragons to my will. But how will that serve me, if the price is death?
Your brother did not sound the horn himself, nor must you.
Macaro pointed to the band of steel.
Here, blood for fire, fire for blood. Who blows the hell horn matters not. The dragons will come to the horn's master. You must claim the horn with blood.
Arya. The heads had been dipped in tar to slow the rot. Every morning when Arya went to the well to draw fresh water for Roose Bolton's basin, she had to pass beneath them. They faced outward, so she never saw their faces. But she liked to pretend that one of them was Joffrey. She tried to picture how his pretty face would look dipped in tar. If I was a crow, I could fly down and peck off his stupid, fat, pouty lips. The heads never lacked for attendance. The carrion crows wheeled about the gatehouse in raucous unkindness and quarrelled upon the ramparts over each eye, screaming and cawing at each other and taking to the air whenever a sentry passed along the battlements. Sometimes the maester's ravens joined the feast as well, flapping down from the rookery on wide black wings. When the ravens came, the crows would scatter, only to return the moment the larger birds were gone. Do the ravens remember Maester Tothmuir? Arya wondered. Are they sad for him? When they quark at him, do they wonder why he doesn't answer? Perhaps the dead could speak to them in some secret tongue the living could not hear. Tothmuir had been sent to the axe for dispatching birds to Castle Rock and King's Landing the night Harrenhal had fallen, Lucan the armourer for making weapons for the Lannisters, Goodwife Hera for telling Lady Went's household to serve them, the steward for giving Lord Tywin the keys to the treasure vault. The cook was spared, some said, because he made the weasel soup, but stocks were hammered together for Pretty Pyre and the other women who'd shared their favours with Lannister soldiers. Stripped and shaved, they were left in the middle ward beside the bear pit, free for the use of any man who wanted them. Three Frey men-at-arms were using them that morning as Arya went to the well. She tried not to look, but she could hear the men laughing. The pail was very heavy, once full. She was turning to bring it back to Kingspire when goodwife Amabel seized her arm. The water went slushing over the side onto Amabel's legs.
"You did it on purpose,"
the woman screeched. "What do you want?" Arya squirmed in her grasp. Amabel had been half-crazed since they'd cut Hara's head off.
"See there?"
Amabel pointed across the yard at Pyre.
"When this Northman falls, you'll be where she is."
"Let me go." She tried to wrench free, but Amabel only tightened her fingers.
"He will fall too. Harrenhal pulls them all down in the end. Lord Tywin's one now. He'll be marching back with all his powers, and then it will be his turn to punish the disloyal. And don't think he won't know what you did."
The old woman laughed.
"I may have a turn at you myself. Hara's had an old broom. I'll save it for you. The handle's cracked and splintery."
Arya swung the bucket. The weight of the water made it turn in her hand, so she didn't smash Amabel's head in as she wanted. But the woman let go of her anyway when the water came out and drenched her. "Don't ever touch me," Arya shouted, "or I'll kill you. You get away." Supping, goodwife Amabel jabbed a thin finger at the flayed man on the front of Arya's tunic.
"You think you're safe with that little bloody man on your tit, but you're not. The Lannisters are coming. See what happens when they get here."
3/4 of the water had splashed out on the ground, so Arya had to return to the well. If I told Lord Bolton what she'd said, her head would be up next to Hara's before it got dark, she thought as she drew up the bucket again. She wouldn't, though. Once, when there had been only half as many heads, Gendry had caught Arya looking at them.
"Admiring your work?" he asked.
He was angry because he'd liked Lucan, she knew, but it still wasn't fair. "It's still Shanks Walton's work," she said defensively, "and the Mummers, and Lord Bolton."
"And who gave us all them?"
"You,
and your weasel soup."
Arya punched his arm. "It was just hot broth. You hated Sir Aemery, too."
"I ate this lot worse. Sir Aemery was fighting for his lord, but the Mummers as sellswords and turncloaks. Half of them can't even speak the common tongue. Septonot likes little boys. Qyburn does black magic. And your friend Biter eats people."
The worst thing was, she couldn't even say he was wrong. The brave companions did most of the foraging for Harrenhal, and Roose Bolton had given them the task of rooting out Lannisters. Vargo Hoat had divided them into 4 bands to visit as many villages as possible. He led the largest group himself and gave the others to his most trusted captains. She had heard Rorg laughing over Lord Vargo's way of finding traitors. All he did was return to places he had visited before under Lord Tywin's banner and seize those who had helped him. Many had been bought with Lannister silver, so the Mummers often returned with bags of coin as well as baskets of heads.
"A riddle!"
Shagwell would shout gleefully.
"If Lord Bolton's goat eats the men who fed Lord Lannister's goat, how many goats are there?"
"1, Arya said when he asked her.
"No, there's a weasel, clever as a goat."
The fool tittered. Rorg and Biter were as bad as the others. Whenever Lord Bolton took a meal with the garrison, Arya would see them there among the rest. Biter gave off a stench like bad cheese, so the brave companions made him sit down near the foot of the table, where he could grunt and hiss to himself and tear his meat apart with fingers and teeth. He would sniff at Arya when she passed, but it was Rorg who scared her most. He sat up near faithful Erzvik, but she could feel his eyes crawling over her as she went about her duties. Sometimes she wished she had gone off across the narrow sea with Jake and Hagar. She still had the stupid coin he'd given her, a piece of iron no larger than a penny, and rusted along the rim. One side had writing on it, queer words she could not read. The other showed a man's head, but so worn that all his features had rubbed off. He said it was of great value, but that was probably a lie too, like his name and even his face. That made her so angry that she threw the coin away. But after an hour she got to feeling bad and went and found it again, even though it wasn't worth anything. She was thinking about the coin as she crossed the flowstone yard, struggling with the weight of the water in her pail. "Nan?" a voice called out. "Put down that pail and come and help me." Elmar Frey was no older than she was, and short for his age besides. He had been rolling a barrel of sand across the uneven stone, and was red-faced from exertion. Arya went to help him. Together they pushed the barrel all the way to the wall and back again, then stood it upright. She could hear the sand shifting around inside as Elmar pried open the lid and pulled out a chainmail hauberk. "Do you think it's clean enough?" As Roos Bolton's squire, it was his task to keep the mail shiny bright. "You need to shake out the sand. There's still spots of rust, see?" She pointed. "You'd best do it again." "You do it." Elmar could be friendly when he needed help, but afterward he would always remember that he was a squire and she was only a serving girl. He liked to boast how he was a son of the Lord of the Crossing, not a nephew or a bastard or a grandson, but a true-born son, and on account of that he was going to marry a princess. Arya didn't care about his precious princess and didn't like him giving her commands. "I have to bring my lord water for his basin. He's in his bedchamber being leeched. Not the regular black leeches, but the big pale ones." Elmer's eyes got as big as boiled eggs. Leeches terrified him, especially the big pale ones that looked like jelly until they filled up with blood. "I forgot you're too skinny to push such a heavy barrel." "I forgot you're stupid." Arya picked up the pail. "Maybe you should get leeched too. There's leeches in the neck as big as pigs." She left him there with his barrel. The Lord's bedchamber was crowded when she entered. Qyburn was in attendance, and Duer Walton, in his mail shirt and greaves, plus a dozen Freys, all brothers, half-brothers and cousins. Roos Bolton lay abed, naked. Leeches clung to the inside of his arms and legs and dotted his pallid chest, long, translucent things that turned a glistening pink as they fed. Bolton paid them no more mind than he did Arya.
"We must not allow Lord Tywin to trap us here in Harrenhal," Sir Aenys Frey was saying as Arya filled the washbasin. A grey-stooped giant of a man with watery red eyes and huge, gnarled hands. Sir Aenys had brought 1,500 Frey swords south to Harrenhal, yet it often seemed as if he were helpless to command even his own brothers.
"The castle is so large it requires an army to hold it, and once surrounded, we cannot feed an army, nor can we hope to lay in sufficient supplies. The country is ash, the villages given over to wolves, the harvest burnt or stolen. Autumn is on us, yet there is no food in store and none being planted. We live on forage, and if the Lannisters deny that to us, we will be down to rats and shoe-leather in a moon's turn."
"I do not mean to be besieged here." Roos Bolton's voice was so soft that men had to strain to hear it, so his chambers were always strangely hushed.
"What then?" demanded Sir Jared Frey, who was lean, balding, and pockmarked.
"Is Edmure Tully so drunk on his victory that he thinks to give Lord Tywin battle in the open field?"
"If he does, he'll beat them," Arya thought. "He'll beat them, as he did on the Red Fork, you'll see." Unnoticed, she went to stand by Kyburn.
"Lord Tywin is many leagues from here," Bolton said calmly. "He has many matters yet to settle at King's Landing. He will not march on Harrenhal for some time."
Sir Aenys shook his head stubbornly.
"You do not know the Lannisters as we do, my lord. King Stannis thought that Lord Tywin was 1,000 leagues away as well, and it undid him."
The pale man in the bed smiled faintly as the leeches nursed of his blood.
"I am not a man to be undone, sir."
"Even if River Run marshals all its strength, and the young wolf wins back from the west, how can we hope to match the numbers Lord Tywin can send against us? When he comes, he will come with far more power than he commanded on the Green Fork. Highgarden has joined itself to Joffrey's cause, I remind you."
"I had not forgotten." "I have been Lord Tywin's captive once," said Sir Hustine,
a husky man with a square face, who was said to be the strongest of the frays.
"I have no wish to enjoy Lannister hospitality again."
Sir Harrys Haig, who was a fray on his mother's side, nodded vigorously.
"If Lord Tywin could defeat a seasoned man like Stannis Baratheon, what chance will our boy king have against him?"
He looked round to his brothers and cousins for support, and several of them muttered agreement.
"Someone must have the courage to say it," Sir Hustine said. "The war is lost. King Rob must be made to see that."
Roose Bolton studied him with pale eyes.
"His Grace has defeated the Lannisters every time he has faced them in battle."
"He has lost the North," insisted Hustine Frey. "He has lost Winterfell. His brothers are dead."
For a moment, Arya forgot to breathe.
"Ted? Bran? And Rickon? Ted? What does he mean? What does he mean about Winterfell? Joffrey could never take Winterfell, never. Rob would never let him."
Then she remembered that Rob was not at Winterfell. He was away in the west, and Bran was crippled, and Rickon only 4. It took all her strength to remain still and silent, the way Cyrio Forel had taught her, to stand there like a stick of furniture. She felt tears gathering in her eyes and willed them away.
"It's not true. It can't be true. It's just some Lannister lie."
"Had Stannis won, all might have been different,"
Ronald Rivers said wistfully. He was one of Lord Walder's bastards.
"Stannis lost," Sir Hustin said bluntly. "Wishing it were otherwise will not make it so. King Rob must make his peace with the Lannisters. He must put off his crown and bend the knee, little as he may like it."
"And who will tell him so?"
Bruce Bolton smiled.
"It is a fine thing to have so many valiant brothers in such troubled times. I shall think on all you've said."
His smile was dismissal. The Freys made their courtesies and shuffled out, leaving only Kyburn, Steelshanks Walton, and Arya. Lord Bolton beckoned her closer.
"I am bled sufficiently, Nan. You may remove the leeches."
"At once, my lord." It was best never to make Roose Bolton ask twice. Arya wanted to ask him what Sir Hustine had meant about Winterfell, but she dared not. "I'll ask Elmer," she thought. "Elmer will tell me." The leeches wriggled slowly between her fingers as she plucked them carefully from the lord's body, their pale bodies moist to the touch and distended with blood. "They're only leeches," she reminded herself. "If I close my hand, they'd squish between my fingers."
"There is a letter from your lady wife."
Kyburn pulled a roll of parchment from his sleeve. Though he wore maester's robes, there was no chain about his neck. It was whispered that he had lost it for dabbling in necromancy.
"You may read it," Bolton said.
The Lady Walder wrote from the twins almost every day, but all the letters were the same. "I pray for you morning, noon, and night, my sweet lord," she wrote, "and count the days until you share my bed again. Return to me soon, and I will give you many true-born sons to take the place of your dear Dumeric and rule the dread fort after you." Arya pictured a plump pink baby in a cradle, covered with plump pink leeches. She brought Lord Bolton a damp washcloth to wipe down his soft, hairless body.
"I will send a letter of my own," he told the one-time maester. "To the Lady Walder?"
"To Sir Helman Tallheart."
A rider from Sir Helman had come 2 days past. Tallheart men had taken the castle of the Dairies, accepting the surrender of its Lannister garrison after a brief siege.
"Tell him to put the captives to the sword and the castle to the torch by command of the king. Then he is to join forces with Robert Glover and strike east towards Duskendale. Those are rich lands and hardly touched by the fighting. It is time they had a taste. Glover has lost a castle and Tallheart a son. Let them take their vengeance on Duskendale."
"I shall prepare the message for your seal, my lord."
Arya was glad to hear that the castle of the Dairies would be burnt. That was where they'd brought her when she'd been caught after a fight with Joffrey, and where the queen had made her father kill Sansa's wolf. It deserves to burn. She wished that Robert Glover and Sir Helman Tallheart would come back to Harrenhal, though. They had marched too quickly before she'd been able to decide whether to trust them with her secret.
"I will hunt today,"
Roose Bolton announced, as Qyburn helped him into a quilted jerkin.
"Is it safe, my lord?"
Qyburn asked.
"Only 3 days past, Sept and Utsmen were attacked by wolves. They came right into his camp, not 5 yards from the fire, and killed 2 horses.
It is wolves I mean to hunt. I can scarcely sleep at night for their howling."
Bolton buckled on his belt, adjusting the hang of sword and dagger.
"It said that direwolves once roamed the north in great packs of 100 or more, and feared neither man nor mammoth, but that was long ago, and in another land. It is queer to see the common wolves of the south so bold."
"Terrible times breed terrible things, my lord."
Bolton showed his teeth in something that might have been a smile.
"Are these times so terrible, maester?"
"A summer is gone, and there are 4 kings in the realm."
"One king may be terrible, but 4, he shrugged. "Nan, my fur cloak."
She brought it to him.
"My chambers will be clean and orderly upon my return," he told her as she fastened it. "And tend to Lady Walder's letter."
"As you say, my lord."
The lord and maester swept from the room, giving her not so much as a backward glance. When they were gone, Arya took the letter and carried it to the hearth, stirring the logs with a poker to wake the flames anew. She watched the parchment twist, blacken, and flare up. "If the Lannisters hurt Bran and Rickon, Rob will kill them every one. He'll never bend the knee, never, never, never. He's not afraid of any of them." Curls of ash floated up the chimney. Arya squatted beside the fire, watching them rise through a veil of hot tears. "If Winterfell is truly gone, is this my home now? Am I still Arya, or only Nan the serving girl, forever and forever and forever?" She spent the next few hours tending to the lord's chambers. She swept out the old rushes and scattered fresh, sweet-smelling ones, laid a fresh fire in the hearth, changed the linens, and fluffed the feather bed, emptied the chamber pots down the privy shaft and scrubbed them out, carried an armload of soiled clothing to the washerwomen, and brought up a bowl of crisp autumn pears from the kitchen. When she was done with the bedchamber, she went down half a flight of stairs to do the same in the great solar, a spare draughty room as large as the halls of many a smaller castle. The candles were down to stubs, so Arya changed them out. Under the windows was a huge oaken table where the lord wrote his letters. She stacked the books, changed the candles, put the quills and inks and sealing wax in order. A large ragged sheepskin was tossed across the papers. Arya had started to roll it up when the colours caught her eye. The blue of lakes and rivers, the red dots where castles and cities could be found, the green of woods. She spread it out instead. The lands of the Trident, said the ornate script beneath the map. The drawing showed everything from the neck to the Blackwater Rush. There's Harrenhal, at the top of the big lake, she realized. But where's Riverrun? Then she saw. It's not so far. The afternoon was still young by the time she was done, so Arya took herself off to the Godswood. Her duties were lighter as Lord Bolton's cupbearer than they had been under Whis or even Pinkeye, though they required dressing like a page and washing more than she liked. The hunt would not return for hours, so she had a little time for her needlework. She slashed at birch leaves till the splintery point of the broken broomstick was green and sticky. Sir Gregor, she breathed, Dunson, Polliver, Raff the Sweetling. She spun and leapt and balanced on the balls of her feet, darting this way and that, knocking pine cones flying. The Tickler, she called out one time, the Hound the next, Sir Ilion, Sir Merrin, Queen Cersei. The bole of an oak loomed before her, and she lunged to drive her point through it, grunting, Joffrey, Joffrey, Joffrey. Her arms and legs were dappled by sunlight and the shadows of leaves. A sheen of sweat covered her skin by the time she paused. The heel of her right foot was bloody where she'd skinned it, so she stood one-legged before the heart tree and raised her sword in salute. Velar Morgulis, she told the old guards of the north. She liked how the words sounded when she said them. As Arya crossed the yard to the bathhouse, she spied a raven circling down toward the rookery and wondered where it come from and what message it carried. Might be it's from Rob, come to say it wasn't true about Bran and Rickon. She chewed on her lip, hoping. If I had wings, I could fly back to Winterfell and see for myself. And if it was true, I'd just fly away, fly up past the moon and the shining stars, and see all the things in old Nan's stories, dragons and sea monsters and the Titan of Braavos, and maybe I wouldn't ever fly back, unless I wanted to. The hunting party returned near Evenfall with 9 dead wolves. 7 were adults, big grey-brown beasts, savage and powerful, their mouths drawn back over long yellow teeth by their dying snarls. But the other 2 had only been pups. Lord Bolton gave orders for the skins to be sewn into a blanket for his bed.
Cubs still have that soft fur, my lord, one of his men pointed out. Make you a nice warm pair of gloves.
Bolton glanced up at the banners waving above the gatehouse towers.
As the Starks won't remind us, winter is coming. Have it done.
When he saw Arya looking on, he said,
Nan, I want a flagon of hot spice wine. I took a chill in the woods. See that it doesn't get cold. I'm of a mind to sup alone. Barley bread, butter and boar.
At once, my lord. That was always the best thing to say. Hot Pie was making oat cakes when she entered the kitchen. 3 other cooks were boning fish, while a spit boy turned a boar over the flames. My lord wants his supper and hot spice wine to wash it down, Arya announced, and he doesn't want it cold. One of the cooks washed his hands, took out a kettle, and filled it with a heavy, sweet red. Hot Pie was told to crumble in the spices as the wine heated. Arya went to help.
I can do it, he said sullenly. I don't need you to show me how to spice wine.
He hates me too, or else he's scared of me. She backed away, more sad than angry. When the food was ready, the cooks covered it with a silver cover and wrapped the flagon in a thick towel to keep it warm. Dusk was settling outside. On the walls, the crows muttered round the heads, like courtiers round the king. One of the guards held the door to King's Pyre.
"Hope that's not weasel soup," he jested.
Roose Bolton was seated by the hearth, reading from a thick leather-bound book, when she entered.
"Light some candles," he commanded her as he turned a page. "It grows gloomy in here."
She placed the food at his elbow and did as he bid, filling the room with flickering light and the scent of cloves. Bolton turned a few more pages with his finger, then closed the book and placed it carefully in the fire. He watched the flames consume it, pale eyes shining with reflected light. The old dry leather went up with a whoosh, and the yellow pages stirred as they burned, as if some ghost were reading them.
"I will have no further need you tonight," he said, never looking at her.
She should have gone, silent as a mouse, but something had hold of her.
"My lord," she asked, "will you take me with you when you leave Harrenhal?"
He turned to stare at her, and from the look in his eyes, it was as if his supper had just spoken to him.
"Did I give you leave to question me, Nen?"
"No, my lord."
She lowered her eyes.
"You should not have spoken then, should you?"
"No, my lord."
For a moment he looked amused.
"I will answer you, just this once. I mean to give Harrenhal to Lord Vargo when I return to the north. You will remain here with him."
"But I don't..."
she started. He cut her off.
"I am not in the habit of being questioned by servants, Nen. Must I have your tongue out?"
He would do it as easily as another man might cuff a dog, she knew.
"No, my lord."
"Then I'll hear no more from you."
"No, my lord."
"Go then. I shall forget this insolence."
Arya went, but not to her bed. When she stepped out into the darkness of the yard, the guard on the door nodded at her and said,
"Storm's coming. Smell the air?"
The wind was gusting. Flames swirling off the torches mounted atop the walls beside the rows of heads. On her way to the Godswood, she passed a wailing tower, where once she had lived in fear of Whis. The Freys had taken it for their own since Harrenhal's fall. She could hear angry voices coming from a window. Many men talking and arguing all at once. Elmar was sitting on the steps outside, alone. "What's wrong?" Arya asked him, when she saw the tears shining on his cheeks.
"My princess," he sobbed, "we've been dishonored. Aenys says there was a bird from the twins. My lord father says I'll need to marry someone else or be a septon."
"A stupid princess," she thought. "That's nothing to cry over."
"My brothers might be dead," she confided. Elmer gave her a scornful look.
"No one cares about a serving girl's brothers."
It was hard not to hit him when he said that. "I hope your princess dies," she said, and ran off before he could grab her. In the guard's wood, she found her broomstick sword where she had left it, and carried it to the heart tree. There she knelt. Red leaves rustled. Red eyes peered inside her. The eyes of the guards.
"Tell me what to do, you guards," she prayed.
For a long moment, there was no sound but the wind and the water and the creak of leaf and limb. And then, far, far off, beyond the Godswood and the haunted towers and the immense stone walls of Harrenhal, from somewhere out in the world, came the long, lonely howl of a wolf. Goose prickles rose on Arya's skin, and for an instant she felt dizzy. Then, so faintly, it seemed as if she heard her father's voice. "When the snows fall and the white winds blow, the lone wolf dies, but the pack survives," he said.
"But there is no pack," she whispered to the weirwood.
Bran and Rickon were dead. The Lannisters had Sansa. John had gone to the wall. "I'm not even me now. I'm Nan."
You are Arya of Winterfell, daughter of the North. You told me you could be strong. You have the wolf blood in you.
The wolf blood? Arya remembered now. I'll be as strong as Rob. I said I would.
She took a deep breath